opinion in In Re Asbestos Litigation versus, Willingham, set out the factors necessary to prove the liability of a premises owner concerning injuries sustained by a independent contractor's employees. And it's, it adopted these factors, which came from a California case, Kinsman. Factors are that the landowner knows or should have known of a concealed previously existing hazard or condition on his premises. And the second factor is the one that's that we're going to be discussing here today. The landowner knew or reasonably should have known that the contractor and his employees did not know and could not reasonably have been expected to know of the hazardous condition. If those factors are met, then the premises owner has a duty to warn or to the contractor or to take corrective action as far as the defect is concerned. In this case, the court granted summary judgment as to because of factor number two, because according to the trial court, there was a complete failure of proof. There was no evidence. There were no facts. Under those circumstances, no inferences flowed to the benefit of the plaintiff, and he granted summary judgment. Like this court in Willingham, the trial court depended a lot on the California case of Kinsman. And I think it's important to note, first of all, there is evidence in this case submitted by the appellants. There are inferences flowing to us, and I believe that the motion for summary judgment was, in fact, erroneously granted.
Why don't you tell us about some of that evidence?
There were three, everybody says there's no direct evidence. Well, there were three employees of DuPont who testified in this case. They were, bear with me.
Well, while you're looking, I know there was some newsletter that you rely on your brief. Is that the correct terminology where the industry would tell people like DuPont what was going on?
Yes, that's part of the proof. We also would present Dr. Castleman, who would testify to the medical and scientific state of the art.
That was the expert in Kinsman.
Yes, sir. And the expert in this case, by the way.
Right.
We designated him. Adrian Lynch headed the industrial hygiene lab in the late 50s at DuPont. And in the late 50s, he became aware of the hazards of asbestos exposure. In a 1967 memo, he suggested work procedures and protective clothing be used, and he set standards for the DuPont workers and also the independent contractors.
Well, this part of your answer seems to suggest DuPont had knowledge, but I thought you were going to tell us about why DuPont also knew the people that invited to the premises did not have knowledge.
Well, I think these witnesses, when they're testifying about the fact they wrote memos to their higher-ups within DuPont, and they said, and the contractor should be included too. Clearly, there's an inference that the DuPont knew that the workers did not know because they should be protected. And when they're saying the respirator program would be policed by the safety department of DuPont, and that they would ensure that the DuPont workers and the independent contractors were wearing the respirators and were protecting themselves. I think clearly that is an inference that DuPont knew that the workers did not know. And also DuPont policed, we're talking about DuPont, the premises owner policed these job sites. And they knew that these workers were working unprotected, even though they had been told that they shouldn't be and that they were at risk of injury and disease. So from that observation alone, when there were memos in the file that says we should be warning workers and protecting them, and when the independent contractors' workers are walking around in the dust without protection, that would be another inference back to us that DuPont knew that the independent contractors didn't know.
Oh, let me make sure I have this clearly. You're saying that there's a memorandum as part of the record from a DuPont employee to someone else in the DuPont company, saying, in effect, asbestos is dangerous. People who are working around asbestos should be wearing respirators. Make sure that our people are wearing respirators, and also make sure that any independent contractors at our job sites are wearing respirators.
Yes, ma'am. I am. And besides that, the memos really go further than that.
Oh, because, and by the way, could you just give me the reference for that one?
It would be Adrian Lynch, Kenneth Cooper, and Ingo Zeiss.
No, but I mean for that particular memo that you're talking about?
Page. Cooper, A1326 to 1343, Zeiss, 1344 through 1346, 1347 through 1350, Lynch, 1351 through 1355, 1357 through 1358, and my source is my brief, Your Honor.
Okay, and all of this is the memo?
It's a statement of what these individuals did at DuPont over what years and what actions they took in relation to the dangers of asbestos, because all of these men worked in either safety department or the industrial hygiene lab. That was their area of expertise. And some of these individuals said that considering the danger, DuPont should immediately cease use of asbestos and find substitute products to be used in their stead.
And what's the appendix site for the memo itself?
I don't know.
Well, maybe you can find that later on. Does the record reflect a situation where the independent contractors were walking around without respirators right next to DuPont employees who were wearing respirators?
Well, I guess we have to use an inference there, Your Honor. The workers said that they were never given respirators during their time at DuPont, and the testimony was that all the workers weren't working in the same area, and the state of the industrial hygiene evidence submitted to the court in the response to the motion for summary judgment says that the talks about the breath or the areas distant from the use of the product that are polluted by the use of asbestos because it floats in the air and causes dust.
Yeah, well, I understand that, but I didn't see it in the record, but my question is, if I was thinking about this with 2020 hindsight and I was one of the plaintiffs, I would say, well, now that I think about it, I was working around this asbestos with no respirator, and now I understand why all these DuPont employees were wearing respirators. Was there any testimony to that effect?
Well, I'm not so sure the DuPont workers were wearing respirators either, Your Honor.
So to the
there was no hint to the workers that there was anything amiss.
I see.
In the have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you.
In the Kinsman case, Your Honor, and I believe we should discuss that briefly, Kinsman is a mirror image of this case. There, the contractor who was injured was a carpenter. He worked for a carpentry independent contractor at the Unocal refinery. The evidence in the case was clear that because of memos written on behalf or to the refinery industry, that in the 1930s and 1940s, they had received reports that asbestos exposure at the refineries was causing workers at the refineries to become ill or could become ill because of exposure to asbestos. The Kinsman Court significantly said there was no evidence about any independent contractor knowing or not knowing of the danger of asbestos. The record was devoid of that. The court said, nevertheless, this issue could be submitted to the jury, and the jury may well find in favor of the defendants, the Unocal and company. But on the other hand, that isn't predestined, that the jury could find under these facts that the plaintiff, that the independent contractors did not know. And it stated that the reason for this dichotomy is that inferences, that a jury could draw inferences from the record. Now, the court did not tell us what the record was, except for a footnote, I believe it was, of Dr. Castleman's testimony. He is a state-of-the-art expert in this case and in that case, and he had testified that by the mid-70s, late-70s, the average citizen of this country would start to understand that asbestos was dangerous. Based upon that, inferences flowing from it, that's out of the time frame, there is an inference that the contractors didn't know. In this case, we had designated Dr. Castleman as a witness to be testifying in this case. At that time, we gave a short summary of Dr. Castleman's testimony, and the court below said, you can't use what was in Kinsman. The court knew, the trial court here knew what the testimony was because it was written in the Kinsman case. And he knew there was relevant testimony toward the issue. But he said, you can't use it because you didn't quote that part of the Castleman testimony in your summary. Well, I could see saying you can't use Castleman if we hadn't designated him and we were trying to bootstrap the case and say, well, there's this guy out there named Castleman, he can do that, but we designated him. Dr. Castleman doesn't come as a surprise to anybody in this room, Your Honor, other than yourselves, because he has been a rock star he has been probably the most opposed person in the United States over the last decade or two. He has testified in many asbestos cases. He's deposed in Delaware. He's testified in Delaware. The defendants know his testimony from beginning to end. His testimony.
Well, I'm having trouble with this. Is there any record in this case of what his testimony?
There is a summary.
Has his deposition been taken? Has he submitted a report?
No.
Is there anything?
This is prior. This is pre-deposition. We were using information from older Castleman depositions in our summary, and our summary, I will admit, did not reference that particular quote in Kinsman. But it did say the state of the art and what his studies were. But everybody knows what Dr. Castleman testifies to, and I submit that
All right, let me stop you here. The trial court reached a decision on summary judgment based upon the absence of evidence, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're saying that part of the reason the court got to that conclusion was because the court refused to consider what Dr. Castleman was going to say, right?
A very small part, but yes. Okay. Because we have, unlike Kinsman, where the court says we don't have any evidence on the the lack of knowledge of the independent contractors, we've given you plenty here.
What was the basis for the trial court saying that it wouldn't consider Castleman's evidence?
That it wasn't in the summary. That particular quote from Dr. Castleman was not in the summary.
So why couldn't you just add it to the summary? Why couldn't you ask for an opportunity to include it?
Well, it was in the order that denied the motion for summary judgment, Your Honor. It was decided.
All right. Well, let's go back just so we can stay focused. You say you presented evidence of lack of knowledge. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Give us one, two, three examples of your evidence to establish lack of knowledge.
All right. Well, we have evidence of safety meetings that were conducted by the independent contractor for the benefit of his employees. And these safety meetings involved routine matters, you know, scaffolding, the use of ladders, keeping your job's area clear of debris and things like that. There was no mention during the course of these meetings of any mention of asbestos. Also, that evidence shows, Your Honor, I believe, that this wasn't this was a serious attempt by the employees of the independent contractors to to inform them of the hazards from the job site. And I think that there is an inference that they never told them about the dangers of asbestos, as bad as that situation was, that that is an inference that if they didn't talk about it, no one, then they didn't know about it because they were really trying to protect their workers. These contractors didn't use asbestos insulation products in their work, but they were around other people. They are assumed to know what these other contractors were doing, like the matter and method of their work and what products they were using. And I submit to you that they did not know. In this case,
I just want to interrupt you for a second. You're using the time you reserve, which you can do.
I understand, Your Honor, and I just thought that I would try to straighten that out.
Sure. And you can continue doing it if you, or do you want to stop and save your time?
No, I just want to make one point. In this case, the court broke your factors down into more. One of the factors that the court looked at that you didn't talk about was, did the employees know of the asbestos from the job site? He held that they did not. Then he went to the hazards, and the judge, you know, significantly said this: if I've already decided that the hazards are that they didn't know the hazard was there, what difference does it make whether they knew about the hazard or not? And I believe the employers are in exactly the same position. They had no reason to know. They didn't know. And why, when we talk about hazard, the starting point should be, did they know asbestos was there? And I believe the answer is no, and there's an inference, Your Honor, in that regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Phillips.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jack Phillips on behalf of E.I. DuPont Dina Moores. DuPont is the appellant in 17 of these 23 cases. I, however, will be speaking on behalf of all of the defendants as to all 23 cases, except for Honeywell, who is going to comment on the Style case, the only case it's in. Your Honor, in the Woolihan case, this Court concisely articulated the elements of a 343 claim. They specifically and clearly enumerated those elements and then remanded the case for the intensive factual inquiry necessary to conclude whether those elements were met. The Woolihan language clearly put the plaintiffs on notice of the elements of a 343 claim. Their burden of proof is to each of those elements, and the fact that there would be a factually intensive inquiry as to whether or not they had proven those elements. Upon remand, the plaintiffs were offered the opportunity to open the record to do additional discovery. Plaintiffs, for their own strategic reasons, with full awareness of the fact that the motions for summary judgment were pending, and full awareness of the burden that had been placed upon them by the Woolihan decision, declined to do any additional discovery. Not only did they decline to do any additional discovery, they objected when Chrysler suggested it wanted to do some additional discovery. One could logically conclude that they didn't want to open the door to this discovery because they were afraid of what might come out. But regardless, they chose not to do any additional discovery. If that creates a problem for them, it's a problem of their own making. But before dwelling on what's not in the record, I'd like to focus just for a second on what is in the record. The court below noted that these plaintiff employees were more sophisticated than the general public. These are longtime union members in a trade skill. They practiced that skill for years upon years upon years in various job sites, coming into contact with multiple other trades. Secondly, as the trial court in both Rocha and Woolihan noted, the contractors hired by the landowners are sophisticated, qualified contractors hired for their expertise. Plaintiffs acknowledge that. The plaintiffs acknowledged that the contractors performed in a workmanlike manner. In the case of DuPont, these contractors signed a contract requiring them to be responsible for the safety of their employees and requiring them to abide by all governmental laws, rules, and regulations. These plaintiffs, as Mr. Lilly has just admitted, testified that their employers had and enforced their own safety rules and conducted their own safety meetings. These plaintiffs and their employers, well, these plaintiffs were members of various unions. Their employer contractors were obviously unionized contractors. They therefore had available them all knowledge available to the local, national, and international unions. It is against this backdrop that plaintiffs' counsel now asks you to decline, excuse me, that the plaintiffs' counsel now asks you to infer, literally out of nothing, that the independent contractors here did not know about the presence of asbestos, were not aware of the hazards of asbestos, could not reasonably have been expected to ascertain the presence or hazards of asbestos, and then on top of all that, to infer that the landowners knew that the plaintiffs and the independent contractors did not know of the presence of asbestos or the hazards of asbestos.
And what's your reaction to Mr. Lilly's argument that if they would have known about asbestos when they were doing these safety briefings, they would have mentioned that in the briefings, but that does not appear to be there?
I say that's pure speculation, Your Honor. If you think about this.
So there's no record support for his summary of.
Oh, no. I apologize, Your Honor. There is record support for the statement that plaintiffs testified that asbestos was not mentioned in their safety meetings. What I say is pure speculation is that one can then leap to the conclusion that the plaintiff's employer did not know or could not have known about the hazards of asbestos. There's nothing in the record to support that one way or the other.
You're suggesting that if a contractor is concerned enough about safety that he has weekly meetings and says, you know, you all have to have protective clothing on or whatever, deal with having properly established the scaffolding and other things that were hazardous, and doesn't mention something that in retrospect we all know is extremely hazardous, that we should just make no assumption about that being an indication of their level of knowledge?
Justice Berger, I don't believe it is an indication of their level of knowledge because, as Mr. Lilly said, what the safety meetings generally conducted or concerned were just elementary things such as tying off ladders, wearing hard hats, perhaps wearing hearing protection. Now, beyond that, what else they did or did not include?
Let's use a slightly different example. Let's say instead of there being asbestos dust in the air, there was chlorine dust that if you inhale even one breath of it, you could destroy your lungs and kill yourself.
Okay.
Presumably, wouldn't an employer, a contractor, say to the employees, now make sure you're wearing your mask all the time because the people next door are using chlorine gas over there? And if they don't say anything like that, wouldn't we assume that it's because they didn't realize either that there was chlorine gas or that it was potentially lethal?
Or perhaps because they were all professionals, they already knew it and understood that.
And then went up and didn't wear a mask?
No, that they understood the risk they were incurring, that they had encountered this on many occasions. Again, these people are longtime union members who have worked in multi-contractor jobs throughout their entire career. They interface with these people daily.
I thought we're talking about a period of time before it became common knowledge that asbestos was dangerous and that you have to wear a mask all the time.
The Kinsman case arose in the 1950s. That's not the case here for these plaintiffs. I mean, for instance, Mr. Helms, the entire DuPont exposure was after the enactment of OSHA. The defendants assert that once OSHA was enacted, the plaintiff's employers were clearly on notice that of the hazards of asbestos and were obliged to be on notice. Mr. Helm on DuPont's premises, we say, is barred under 343 because his employer was on notice. Have I answered your question, Your Honor? I think it's a much later date in these cases is my point. Plaintiff's employer's knowledge of the presence of asbestos was found to be entirely absent from the record by Judge Slights. All the plaintiffs offered as to that, to prove that, as they put it, was that their employers did not know the presence of asbestos because they had no reason to know. They did not have anything to do with the creation of asbestos, and no reason to know the details of other contractors' work. Even if they say that, though, without citation to the record. So even if such facts were sufficient to prove the lack of knowledge, which they are not, there's no evidence of record of such facts. In fact, the plaintiffs actually admit that these alleged facts are nothing more than assumptions. If you look at their opening briefs on page 25 to 26, they say, okay, go through this recitation. It would be reasonable to assume that the plaintiffs did not know. And then based on what they say is reasonable to assume, they then want to draw an inference. But they've got nothing in the record to support the fact that, you know, the plaintiff did not know anything or the plaintiff's employers did not know anything. So what they do is they make an assumption, and then they build on that assumption and ask you to say that's a sufficient base to make an inference. But the assumption alone is not sufficient, particularly when it comes to the assumption that they had no reason to know the details of the other contractor's work. Plaintiff's counsel has argued to this court in both Rocha and Woolahan that these various trades worked on top of one another, within a few feet of one another. He said that again today. The counsel's arguments demonstrate that these contractors interfaced with one another on a daily basis in a manner that caused each contractor to be aware of what the other was doing. Now, secondly, the second item the plaintiff had the burden of proving was the plaintiff's lack of knowledge, plaintiff's employer's lack of knowledge of the hazards of asbestos. The trial court again found that to be wanting because the plaintiffs made no evidence to develop the record. They did not depose their employers. They did not depose their employer's supervisors. They didn't ask any questions. So it's not surprising that, you know, they don't have any evidence in the record. Instead, all they offer you is that asbestos wasn't discussed in safety meetings. Based on the fact that these were sophisticated employers, longtime employees, used to working on these multi-contractor premises, it seems unreasonable that you could just leap to the conclusion based on the fact that this wasn't mentioned in safety meetings, that that would be sufficient to support the inference they seek. And certainly it is not sufficient after the enactment of OSHA. The third item the plaintiffs have failed to prove is that the plaintiffs and the plaintiff's employers lacked the ability to ascertain the hazard. Again, that's clearly a requirement of Woolahan. The plaintiffs argued that, well, they testified to the scope of the work they performed and the nature of the work, but that doesn't get them there. All they were testifying to is their limited duties, their specific duties. There's no testimony as to the nature of the contract, the entire scope of the project, what the plaintiff's employers were told they would have to do as far as interfacing with other contractors. So the fact that the plaintiffs could testify or tell you exactly what they did does not in any way present a factual predicate for an inference that neither they nor their sophisticated employers could have ascertained the hazard. And, you know, this business of looking to Castleman to save them is fallacious. The Castleman, as they say, Castleman's testimony was not in there, was not submitted to the court below. They admit that. They've admitted it here. As a consequence, the use of such testimony is not permitted under this court's decision in Rochester v. Catalan. Even if this court were to consider the Castleman quote, there are at least four reasons why it doesn't matter. First is that Castleman's quote dealt only with the general public's lack of knowledge and is not probative as to the plaintiff's specific employer's lack of knowledge. These are sophisticated contractors in specialized trade who presumably possessed industry knowledge superior to the general public's. Third, Castleman's testimony spoke only to the general knowledge in the 1950s. And fourth, perhaps most importantly, Castleman's opinion in Kinsman would not be admissible in the Delaware asbestos litigation. Castleman has been ruled to be a historian and as such can only testify to what information was available and when, but cannot offer information or an opinion as to what anybody knew or should have known. And that's particularly true in light of the fact that Castleman repeatedly has consistently always testified that he does not offer plaintiff-specific testimony and does not know anything about the individual plaintiffs or about their specific employers. This court's Woolihan opinion requires that this be a employer-specific showing. The burden is on the plaintiff to make that employer-specific showing that their employer did not know and could not have known. They have not done that. Lastly, the fourth point, the plaintiffs have not presented any evidence that the landowners knew or should have known of the fact that the plaintiffs and the plaintiffs' employers did not know of the presence of asbestos or were not aware of the hazards. You know, it's logically impossible to demonstrate the landowners' awareness of things that are absolutely unsupported in the record. But logic aside, all the plaintiffs offer you is that, first of all, they assert that the trial court erroneously required them to prove that the defendant knew or should have known that the plaintiff's employers were unaware or could not reasonably have been aware or expected to know. They say that on page 38 of the brief. That's diametrically opposed to what this court's Woolihan opinion says. Secondly, they argue that the manner in which the landowners treated them demonstrates that the landowners were aware of plaintiffs' and plaintiffs' employers' lack of knowledge. This is the business that the underlying factual predicate is that the landowners observed the plaintiffs working around asbestos-containing materials without respirators or dust masks. But yet again, they offer no citation in the record for that underlying predicate fact, none whatsoever. All of these plaintiffs testified that they never had any work-related contact with a landowner's employees. Mr. Lilly has referred you to some DuPont employees. First of all, just by the way, his citation to Adrian Lynch out of his record does not include the memo he talks about. It only includes deposition testimony. One of the other people that he mentioned as a DuPont employee was Mr. Kuiper, who plaintiffs cite as testifying that the respiratory protection policy was enforced by DuPont, and he believes there was compliance by the contractors. So on the one hand, Mr. Lilly wants to argue that these plaintiffs were observed without respiratory protection. On the other hand, he cites you to the very record that supports what I'm saying, A, that he's either dead wrong, that we thought there was compliance, or that there's no evidence in the record that anybody from DuPont saw the lack of compliance. In any event, what you have left is the plaintiff's ipsa dixa assertion as to these four elements. That the landowners observed the plaintiffs without respiratory protection, no evidence in the record. There was reason to believe that the particular plaintiffs were working in proximity to friable asbestos, no evidence in the record. Landowners knew that the plaintiffs and their employers could not assess or evaluate that risk, no evidence in the record. Landowners could reasonably have concluded that the plaintiffs and their employers had no reason to know of the presence of asbestos. Again, no evidence in the record. There is no support for any of these assumptions. That's why the plaintiff's brief doesn't contain any citations for any of these. The last thing...
I thought there was an evidence in the record about other people who worked in the areas about the same time, and they were trying to make an indirect reference that would connect the plaintiffs to the asbestos.
I'm sorry, Justice Holland, I missed that. Would you repeat that
for me? It was my understanding that they introduced testimony of people other than the plaintiffs who were working with DuPont, for example, and they wanted to somehow make a connection that these other individuals' knowledge of what was going on would lead to an inference that these plaintiffs were exposed. Is that correct?
They assert that DuPont had knowledge of the hazard of asbestos. The lower court said there was sufficient evidence in the record to infer that as being the case, and that's why I'm not arguing about DuPont's knowledge. What I believe is at issue is their proof. They have to prove the lack of knowledge of the plaintiffs, and they haven't done that. Whether you look at
The best evidence you alluded to earlier would have been to depose their own employers.
Yes. I mean, directly. Obviously, easily done. Or their employer's supervisors. That's all they had to do. They didn't bother to do it. They made no effort. Instead, what they want to rely on now is the landowner's promulgation of general safety rules as indicating an awareness that the plaintiffs and employers lacked knowledge of the hazard of asbestos.
From DuPont's bottom line position in this appeal is that the Superior Court's opinion was entirely correct.
Absolutely. Based on the record the Superior Court had, they placed nothing in the record before them. The law of inferences does not allow a court to make up whole cloth or to conjecture whatever the plaintiffs might want to spin on the basis of information they happen to find tidbits here and there, and that's all they've got. They didn't do what they were instructed to do by this court. They didn't go back and make the record they needed. And so now they're grasping at straws out of what is in the record and asking you to make giant leaps. It's nothing more than conjecture or speculation. But, for instance, the enactment of general safety or elementary safety reminders is nothing more than general superintendence. They prove nothing with regard to DuPont's or any other landowner's knowledge as to what the plaintiffs or their employers knew or should have known or could have known. I would suggest, as you have done, that every time Mr. Lilly tells you there is evidence in the record, you ought to ask him who says, because the answer is consistently, it's only Mr. Lilly. There's no citations. In light of the lack of evidence in the record and their failure to prove the necessary elements of Woolahan, what the plaintiffs now seek or ask this court to do is simply to misconstrue the law of inferences. And really what they want this court to do is to gut the Woolahan decision and basically waive the requirements that they established the elements listed as 343 as enunciated in Woolahan. They're asking in essence that you overturn your own decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Albert Mamwaring from Pepper Hamilton on behalf of the defendant appellee Honeywell in the Steele case in this consolidated appeal. I have two brief points in the minute that I have. First point is that the same evidentiary problems that were present in the representative cases before the trial court all exist. Also in the Steele case, and for the same reasons articulated by DuPont as counsel in their papers, Honeywell would also be entitled to judgment as a matter of law. But there's an additional and separate ground, apart from the grounds relied upon by the trial court below in the representative cases to affirm summary judgment on behalf of Honeywell, and that is time and place causation. Still has not demonstrated that he was ever exposed to asbestos on Honeywell's Claymont facility. He worked as an iron worker for 4 months and then 2 years for a sporadic period of time. He estimates in the record at one point maybe 2 days. No particular time exactly within that 4 month or 2 year period of what those days were, no particular pace, and he also establishes that he didn't see asbestos and wasn't exposed to asbestos on the premises. He relies upon other workers.
Your minute went by quickly.
Pardon me?
Your minute went by very quickly.
Oh, I'm sorry. He tries to rely on other workers, and there's no time or place link between those workers either, and so accordingly, it's a separate and independent ground. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you all for your arguments. Oh, do you have something else, Mr. Lilly?
Very briefly,
first of all, I'm reminded, Your Honor, that we presented deposition testimony about the individuals and the memorandums. The memorandums were never in our possession. It was his testimony about it. I would like to suggest to...
All right, so there are no memorandums in the record?
No, Your Honor, but there's testimony in the record that I wrote a memorandum to my superiors.
Okay, well, I misunderstood your earlier argument. I thought you said that what were they doing, summarizing the memorandum or talking about...
They were talking about their job and what their knowledge was of the hazards of asbestos and what they did. And they said, one of them said, I wrote a memorandum to my superiors where I said we should stop using asbestos and about the program for respirators.
Okay, thanks.
We're talking about it would be very simple for us to go back and to depose the employers. Well, you have to remember that these guys worked out of a union hall for the low bidder. It wasn't cradle to grave benefits from an employer. They worked with the guy as long as the job was there. Then they went off to someplace else. They were independent contractors, really, working for an independent contractor. This happened 40 or 50 years ago. I would dare say that few of those organizations are there, and none of the management and of those corporations are now, Mr. Phillips says this was easily done. I believe it would be an impossible task. But I want to call your attention back to the California case where there was no evidence. There was Castleman, a very thin reed upon which they said, yes, a jury question was presented, and I've given you a lot more than that. And I thank you for your time, Your Honor. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.